Hi, I'm Chris Bedford, Dorothy Wagner Wallace Director of the Baltimore Museum of Art, and welcome to Art Matters, a monthly feature where we provide insights into the work of some of today's most creative artists from Baltimore and beyond. Joining me today is Melvin Edwards, an acclaimed sculptor who divides his time between New York, Baltimore, and Senegal. Mel, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I thought I would open with a question that relates to a forthcoming exhibition at the BMA. There's an exhibition we're doing of your work named Crossroads, and it focuses in particular on the body of sculpture that you've been creating since your first trip to Lagos in 1977. Could you describe just a little bit your experience of Africa, that founding moment, and as it relates to your trajectory in sculpture ever since?
Well, my first trip to Africa was 7 years before that, the year 1970, and it was an Educators to Africa trip. But I had wanted to go for many years. I didn't either have the funds or time to do it. But when I went in 1970, it opened eyes and doors for me and relationships. And those were corroborated then when Festac came in 1977. I started to have direct relationships with African artists, which was good because often they were of my own generation. So they had their own aspirations in relation to the countries they were beginning to represent. And as they were often newly independent, some of them had real positive dreams about what they could do and what they could innovate and how they could influence what the future would be. Several of them became very close friends, like the artist-architect Dema Sunwoko, or the sculptor Ben Osawe, and many others. And I met some older ones, Nana Osebonsu of Ghana, who was in his 70s then, my father's generation, a traditional carver. When he saw my work, he said, "Machines, beautiful," you know. In other words, a response to what somebody else would say was modern Western kind of art or sculpture. This sculptor, who was quite deeply in the tradition, responded quite directly as an artist to my work. And what I found was that you didn't have to worry about what you were really doing or what somebody else. There would be a great variety. I quickly became aware that art is like language. People invent languages all over the world for their own reasons, and they invent enough to culturally express themselves, to scientifically express themselves, you know, just all kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. And it was just a bunch of positive experiences. What this meant to my work, I don't know that I could pick out a stylistic difference. There is one work that I remember conceptually I developed over several years called Asafo Krano. And it came from a sculptural concept which existed in Ghana, the Asafo societies, which were organizations of usually young men and were meant for community self-defense. But they created ritual sites and situations which were combinations of architecture, sculpture, and they were polychromatic, they were abstract, and they were figurative, they were symbolic, they were the whole range of things. If you were writing a book on contemporary art and you just took the trouble to understand conceptually what was going on, you realize, well, they had the world covered in these things. Well, I then found there were similar structures in other African countries and societies, which were, again, combinations of architecture, sculpture, and other aspects, and often were used as performance sites, you know, some religious, some for other purposes. But the recognition that everything was possible already in African art, and what that meant was I wasn't really discovering anything that wasn't going on in the West in one hand, but on the other hand, I was, because it just made me know that was true there. And eventually, when I went to Japan, I realized, well, Japanese culture had the same broad structures. And I guess everything about Africa has been a corroboration, and it's not put any limitations. In other words, I could use something that was brand new, scientific. It could be not just visual. It could be include sound. It could include all kinds of things.
So that phrase, I want to pick up on it for a second here, corroboration.
Mm-hmm.
It's a phrase I've heard you use over the years. Mm-hmm. It's not a phrase I've heard any other artist use. Mm. I think it's deeply meaningful in your work. So could you just slightly unpack what corroboration means, specifically in relationship to Africa?
Well, you know, in the United States, when you say the Black Arts Movement, or you say African or African-American, or you say Afro or Negro, all of those things, when you boil it down, it means African origins. And it's pluralistic. It's not singular, and it's not limited. And one of the things that when I use the phrase corroboration or the word, is that the tendency of human beings to look at something, create something, invent something, play with something, destroy something, all of those things are human activities, and they reflect our philosophies as, you know, as beings. Of course, the idea of art, for me, is that it's on the creative side, not the destructive, you know. And I just found corroborations of that. I mean, people in not just Nigeria, that was where Festac was, but in my travels through the years when I went to Zimbabwe and worked there two different summers, their modern arts movement is in stone primarily. They paint, but the local evolution, and it's all 20th century. In fact, you can say post-mid-20th century, but they search into their history, their mythology, and at the same time, they had information on modern art. And at the same time, they weren't constricted except by the materials they were working with and their own ideas. And so there was a great deal of variety, some quite self-taught, and you might say naive, and some very, very sophisticated in dealing with outer space. And what I found was each place tended to have its own uniqueness. And then within those places, there was variety. You know, some who were very traditional, some who were looking at tomorrow. And I think where we see it now is so many African younger artists who've been educated in Europe, their work resonates so much like ordinary, if you will, modern art, modern ideas. The only thing is they haven't had those names as the right artist and that sort of thing. But I remember a statement by Ben Osawe, who I met in that my first visits to Nigeria, who's a sculptor, modern, from Benin. He'd been educated in England. I forget which of the schools, the Slade or one of those. But one of those persons that he encountered looked at his work and he said, "Oh, you're very influenced by Henry Moore." And he said, "Well, you know, Henry Moore was very influenced by my father because his father had been a traditional carver." I don't think the influence either way was direct, you know, but I think the fact that a person is living in the 20th century, there's television in Nigeria, there's television in London, you know, there's television in New York or Sao Paulo. The world is in touch in many ways, ways we don't often realize. And it just made me, if you will, feel good about my perennial interest in reading and in history and things like that. You know, when I was a teenager, there was a book that showed up at my house. I think my mother got it from the Book of the Month Club, called Kabluna. And it was about Inuit or Eskimo people. And this is the 1940s or not around 1950. And I was quite young, you know, 11 or 12, but I'd started to have a big interest in reading adventure and history. And years later, when things like that were part of the television life, I saw photographs and film that was from that same book, Kabluna. And, you know, Eskimo art is in the package, you know. The world's art is in the package. And when I went to China in 1996, that was a part of things. I found corroborations. I found work that was terrifying to look at because some artists had some reason to make a terrifying looking thing. At the same time, serenity. We talk about abstraction as, you know, a really forward-moving idea, as if it were brand new. And I was talking with one of my students who was from China, and she said, well, we call that the art of empty space, and that it was an old conceptual idea about art. And when I went to China in 96, and I was asked to do a lecture for the sculptors who did large-scale public things, and I was about halfway through my lecture, and a bright light came on in my head, and it said to me, I'm talking to people here as if our art is modern and theirs is not. And people who have a history of 10 to 20,000 years of culture that's been tangible, visible, and ongoing, and they wrote treatises on aesthetic ideas and problems, says, I'm really here to be educated, but I'm giving my lecture anyway.
Mel, I wanted to talk about your Lynch Fragments series, which spans several decades. Could you tell us a little bit about how that series began and how it's evolved over time?
Well, first of all, there was no series in the beginning. So it didn't start off with the title or even topic Lynch Fragments per se. I was a young sculptor. This was approximately 1963. I had been welding occasionally for 2 or 3 years. I really started to learn to weld in 1960. But I was a painter and was headed up the road to a kind of personal abstract expressionism with personal symbols involved. But the sculpture began to help me with ideas in ways that the painting wasn't. And I got more curious about it. A graduate student sculptor taught me how to weld. I had studied sculpture a little bit, but the truth is it wasn't a part of my education. You know, sculpture really, I like to say, at least to myself, and anybody else who wants to hear it this way, I'm self-taught. I realize things about sculpture. I'm not like, say, the great sculptor David Smith, who was already a hyper-qualified industrial welder, you know. And so his work literally shows that, both in concept and in technique. Mine is a bit more rough much of the time. No, I can weld just as perfectly, I guess, as anybody, because if you practice even self-taught for 50 years, you figure some things out, you know. But I don't think it ever got to be as important to me as it was, you know, to him. A couple of the sculptors whose work that I liked very much were George Sugarman, and it was because he was polychrome. He was experimenting with color and form. And other sculptors had put paint and color on sculpture, but I felt he did it with another level, a deeper level of knowledge and applicability in particular to form. For the Lynch Fragments, they allowed me to participate in the world of the living, if you will. That is, people refer to the African-American struggle for equity and fairness in life as the civil rights movement. Well, human rights are always something human beings have had to fight for, because always there have been periods and persons who would exploit people. Our struggle grapples with the racial aspect, but the truth is it's very much about exploitation. I grew up in a Southern American city where segregation, which is legal, it's not discrimination, it's legal segregation, and that means you cannot do this or you cannot do that because it broke the law. Well, we worked with it and we worked against it, and the movement was there. In the visual arts world, people were saying, well, art can only be for art's sake. That was sort of the general commentary, if you will, in the early 60s. They often gave Clement Greenberg credit for emphasizing that. And I understood what he meant, but he didn't understand in making that statement that way what the whole complex meant to other people. And I thought, no, you didn't have to leave out anything, and you could put in anything you wanted. And the idea of being modern was that you were free to do that. You know, in other words, the 20th century opened up the world visually for everybody. And that meant there were no limits, you know, and therefore commentary or non-commentary, all of it's valid, you know. The main thing was that you did something that was vital and variable. I was experimenting, learning to weld, developing small relief ideas because that was an easy way to teach myself. And then one day in the summer of 63, a piece called Some Bright Morning, then that was its title, which there was no title. I was an experimental, you know, sculptor. The experiment seemed to be giving me something. And as I realized with that work, I was on to something. And then two or three pieces developed. I think it was a piece, Afro Phoenix. And someone bought it. A collector in Chicago had a relative in Los Angeles. And he recommended, her name was Theresa Lakritz. And when she bought Afro Phoenix, the forms in it were interesting in a way that I thought I needed to make a variation on that piece. And so the one that people are apt to see is Afro Phoenix number two, or whatever I title it. But I started to see different things within my own work, which I could pull out newer ideas from the inside of what I was doing. In other words, it's like in music, theme and variation. You develop a form, and then that form gives you other forms. And once you've got something tangible that way, you can pull other forms out of it. So it's an open door for creativity and development, but it's personal, you know. And so I think one of the pieces is called Mojo for 1404. Title-wise, that's the address of my family in the house that I grew up in Houston. Well, there's nothing in the piece that says 1404 Wayne Street to anybody, but to me, it does. But as far as the development of the form, it gave me ideas for pushing forms further. Not only that, in relation to the Lynch fragments, did topical social ideas. I named one for the writer whose work I admired very much, Richard Wright. You know, one of the pieces in our show in Baltimore is dedicated to the poet Leon Gontran Damas of French Guyana, but who was one of the fathers of the Negritude movement, and a friend, because I met him in 1969 and knew him until he passed in 78, and he wanted me to make a piece of sculpture for his old home in Guyana. Unfortunately, he passed before I could do that. But in his honor, respect for his creativity, because in language, he was the first of that group of writers. When I say that group, I mean Aimé Césaire and Léopold Senghor and Leon Damas. Well, Damas was the first of them to publish, and he happened to published his first books, Pigments, or Piment, the year that I was born. So I found things in the generations that came before me and the people that I encountered, and from almost everywhere in the world. Naturally, I have some focus on the places that Africa has had its influences and continues to. And as the world comes more together, yeah, I'm one of those people who likes the idea of the United Nations. Mm. You know, I happen to think that the world needs for everybody to be in contact so they can understand each other.
Mel, the BMA is very honored to have acquired Scales of Injustice, which is an installation that spans many decades. You first executed it in the 70s and then again in 2017. So can you tell us a little bit about the evolution of that idea and that work on view at the BMA in our West Wing now?
Well, then, within my work through the years, sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not. For a person who in his high school years did not care that much for mathematics, but I did like the ideas that were in architecture. And much of architecture is straight line in its development, if you will, geometric, you know, and geometric in three dimensions. And the one thing when I was switching from painting to sculpture and that I wrote out for myself was an emphasis on the difference between the illusion of three dimensions and the reality of three dimensions. And that's what sculpture offered. It offered an entry into space, both physical and psychological. From the Lynch fragments, I found ideas inside. And Scales of Injustice started off way back as a prism kind of form, PRISM, in other words, a way to utilize the corner of a room, because I had started to make works that suspended in space and utilized space. That was in the 60s. The first suspended piece, in fact, was started in 1964, so it was with the Lynch fragments. But it didn't have that kind of linear direct reference to geometry in its overall form. It functioned more with the dynamics of suspension as its core, if you will. With Scales of Injustice, that prismatic form I titled Anna's Corner. And that was, the title was subjective, because when my first child, my daughter, would misbehave, and I would send her to a corner, and she had to stay there.
So then fast forward to 2017.
To 2017, after, well, it was first done at the Whitney Museum, I should say that, 1970. To 2017, when I was offered the opportunity to participate at that aspect of the Venice Biennale, which was an aspect which was going to celebrate the 100 years of the Russian Revolution. And I said, well, why do you want me, you know? And they said, well, we think you've got some ideas that are as progressive as what was developed. So anyway, at the same time, an event happened. I think it was in February of that year. A young immigrant from the Gambia had made his way by one way or another to Venice, and he drowned in front of a group of tourists, and they were sawing and laughing as if it was entertainment, and he literally drowned in the water. I don't know why he was in the water, but I thought their non-humane, you know, that this was entertainment. And then, you know, I know that all of us have migrated or immigrated all over the world for various reasons. And as I had spent time in Senegal, and I think his name was Pathé Diagne, I'm not sure if I have it right. But and then when I got to Venice, it was on my mind, and the space that was allotted me was a large half of a room, but if you will, the triangular division of the space. And I said, this the ideas I have will fit here, but I have to deal with it a bit more complicatedly. And so I made the triangular creation of the space with barbed wire, but at the same time, it seemed like such an unjust, if you will, to be literal, such an unjust fate for that young man. And while I was there that week or two working in Venice, I ran into maybe 50 or 60 different young immigrants of the same background, various places in Africa. I had a conversation one day with one from Nigeria, one another day from Ghana, another day, you know, and it just made more sense. And then when I got off the ferry one day at some site, I don't know the particularities of the site, but it was like the water and the movement of the grass in the water meant that something was speaking to me, that I should really be serious about this, that we're all bound in this. We've all moved in the world. And for it to be our difficulties to be laughed at or ridiculed or pushed aside, that just isn't right in relation to, you know, my family has to welcome other families, and other families have welcomed my family, you know. And anyway, I ended up suspending inside the piece in a quasi plate-like, or if you will, scale-like form, suspended. And on that form, put a pile of chain and barbed wire fragments, and then a fragment of chain on the floor, which could be moved in any configuration. And then the lighting while working on the piece gave me a very interesting possibility. And that was that the lighting, and this was not originally intentional, the idea of a heart that fit right into the corner of the piece on the floor. And it just was natural for the best lighting of the piece in general, and here it was. And so I took advantage of, if you will, that aspect. And I guess it was an illumination, if you will, you know. If there are illuminated ideas, illuminated manuscripts, this is a piece of sculpture that originally didn't have that much interest in the lighting, except at the barbed wire and the line. And what I've evolved through the years is that the work can be something itself, and it can imply many things poetically. My wife, Jane Cortez, used to say, find your own voice, and then use your own voice, and find. So when your work can give you something else. And what I've found is the sculpture has been giving me ideas for paintings, for watercolors and things. And I've been doing that for years, but I didn't start to show them till about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so I have a cabinets full of them, if you will. But the idea that the work can give you a tool or tools to go further mm-hmm. with your work, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so you've not only created a work, so to speak, but you've gotten something that will carry you further. And the older I get, the more interested I am in that, because it's a kind of extra longevity of my ideas, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm happy to still be interested in advancing art through my work, which means you advance life through your life.
Mel, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You can see works by Melvin Edwards at the BMA on view now in Everyday Selections from the Collection and in Melvin Edwards Crossroads and in Generations, A History of Black Abstract Art, all beginning September 29th. Thank you for listening today. Art Matters is produced for WYPR by the Baltimore Museum of Art. And for the Baltimore Museum of Art, I'm Chris Bedford.